Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Federal Reserve wrapped up a meeting today. There was, believe it or not, some news. A moment on the broadcast today for beer and the business end of the end of the world. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 12th of December. And I'll tell you, I honestly can't remember the last time there was a Fed meeting at which news broke. But news there was today, not about interest rates. They're still at zero. Sunday, by the way, is the fourth anniversary of the Fed's zero interest rate policy. No, the news today was on the other end of that bargain, how and when the Fed is going to decide to raise rates. For the first time, the central bank has put a policy number on its policy decisions.
In today's statement, the committee also recasts its forward guidance to clarify how it expects its target for the federal funds rate to depend on future economic developments. Specifically, the committee anticipates that exceptionally low levels for the federal funds rate are likely to be warranted, quote,
all right, wait, stop. Stop the tape. This is too painful. It's going to be easier, honestly, if I just do it. Bernanke said he's going to keep interest rates at or near zero as long as unemployment is above 6.5% and inflation is 2.5% or less. It's kind of a big deal because up till now, the Fed's guidelines for when it was going to raise or lower interest rates has pretty much been, we'll let you know when we feel like it. Maybe we'll do it in, what, a year, year and a half from now? Whatever, you know. So it is a big deal. The Fed chairman had other things to say today, of course. The questions and answers went on for an hour or so, and they give us the perfect entree for another edition of the Fiscal Cliff Time Machine. Our guest, of course, is Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve. Your job is to decide which piece of tape is from this year and the fiscal cliff debate, and which is from last year and the debt limit fight. Here you go. Is it choice one?
In particular, it will be critical that fiscal policymakers come together soon to achieve longer-term fiscal sustainability without adopting policies that could derail the ongoing recovery.
Or is it choice two from this year?
The most helpful thing I think Congress administration can do right now is find a resolution that, on the one hand, achieves long-run fiscal sustainability, which is critical, absolutely critical for a healthy economy, but also avoids derailing the recovery, which is currently in process.
All right. Sorry, trick question. They're both from today, but honestly, most of what Ben Bernanke says does kind of sound the same anyway, don't you think? All right. Elsewhere in big policy news, it is decision time in healthcare again. Not for you. It's states. They have until Friday to decide whether to set up their own healthcare exchanges or to let the federal government do it. Exchanges, you might remember, are those online sites where small businesses and people who aren't insured through their jobs will be able to shop for health insurance starting in 2014. It is a fair question to ask what the difference is, whether states or the feds set up those exchanges. From the Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein breaks it down for us.
Here's one difference. Power.
A state that's going to run its own exchange has an opportunity to really change the entire healthcare landscape if it wants to do that.
That's Georgetown professor Sabrina Corlett. So, say a state has a big obesity problem. The state can make sure all the insurance plans on the exchange cover programs aimed at reducing obesity.
Essentially, the state is using its market clout to get the health plans and the providers to change their behavior and reduce healthcare costs over the long run.
But more than half the states aren't expected to go that route. They'll let the federal government operate their exchanges. But with that comes predictability. Sonia Schwartz at the National Academy for State Health Policy thinks that could be attractive to insurance companies.
Health plans may be able to just come to the federal exchange and fill out their information and select multiple states all at once rather than going to one state at a time.
Everybody wants lots and lots of insurers offering plans on the exchanges. The theory goes the more competition, the lower the price. So I ask Robert Zirkelbach with America's Health Insurance Plans, what does the industry prefer?
It's too early to know how the federal exchange will compare to what the state exchanges are going to look like.
And here's the thing. Insurers have concerns either way. With Washington at the helm, they worry about extra regulation. States, on the other hand, can set standards that make it harder and more costly for companies. No matter what happens, states and the federal government will be racing to get exchanges in place. And Bryce Williams with the consulting firm Towers Watson says there's a lot that can go wrong.
There are definitely going to be some bumps in the first 3 months and years of these state exchanges going live.
Overall, most healthcare analysts agree. The shopping experience going online to pick a plan won't be much different between a federal and a state exchange. The real question is, will insurance be cheaper in one state over another?
We don't know.
We just don't know yet.
Right now, we do not know.
That is anyone's guess at this point. We don't know.
Nope, we don't. And probably won't for a while. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
A correction now before we go on to a story we did yesterday. TARP wasn't what we said it was. It was, as you already know, the Troubled Asset Relief Program. On Wall Street today, not much love for the Fed decision. Not much hate, though, either. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We had the former governor of Minnesota, Tim Pawlenty, on the program last month. He had just started a new job with the Financial Services Roundtable lobbying in Washington. And so I asked him how he came by that job.
I was contacted by an executive search firm that was trying to fill the vacancy, is the technical answer.
Which kind of struck us, because really? Politicians get headhunted? Leslie Hordam is a partner at Spencer Stuart in Washington, D.C. They are an executive search firm, as they like to put it. And she had nothing to do with getting Governor Pawlenty paired up with the Financial Services Roundtable, but she has done her share of politician placement. Leslie, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's get right to it then. Who's better, a former member of Congress or a former governor like Mr. Pawlenty?
Well, it depends, but I will tell you, of course.
I fully appreciate you have to be delicate here. I get that.
We do. But yeah. Where the difference is, quite honestly, at least the perception is, that a former governor has more management experience.
Mm-hmm.
The rule of thumb is that nobody ever hired a former member of Congress to manage things. They hire them for their access, for their
right.
knowledge of a particular area. But governors have that access, have the gravitas, but they also have had some real management experience.
Do you ever get companies or boards, whoever your clients are, who come to you and say, we want Governor X of this state, but that person's term isn't up for like another year?
Yes, that has actually happened. And it's happened to me a couple of times, in fact, to my colleagues and me. And in each case, there was a conversation, and the governor said, look, I really feel it's important for me to finish my term and my commitment, and can't make any promises, but if you're willing to wait and have this conversation in 6, 8, 12 months, whatever it is, I'd love to have the conversation at that time.
Not that this is necessarily your problem, but isn't there sort of a conflict of interest there between the company and the governor or the senator waiting until they get out of office?
Well, certainly we are mindful of that. And if they, for some reason, get further down the road before their term is up, then they are required to recuse themselves from particular issues affecting that industry.
This is a crass way to put it, but who's worth who's worth the most out there?
In terms of former electeds?
Yeah.
You know, again,
former electeds. I love you. You have the category. Former electeds.
I mean, it really depends. So certainly a one-term member of Congress may not have the star power that a ranking member or a former governor or former cabinet secretary has or brings to the table. And quite frankly, in these days, as you can imagine, it's very important to find people who can work in a bipartisan fashion.
Yeah.
If they are somebody who has a reputation of reaching across the aisle and working in a collaborative fashion, that's an attractive piece of the puzzle.
Leslie Hordam, she is at the executive search firm Spencer Stuart in Washington, D.C. Leslie, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Forget the fiscal cliff. That's practically Bush League when you match it up against the end of the world as we know it. It's coming next Friday, if you look at the Mayan calendar a certain way. So what else could we do, really, but a story on the apocalypse economy? Here's Marketplace's Eve Tro.
The notion that the world will end this month has already made at least $770 million.
Daddy, what was that?
Don't look back. Just look at me. Do I look scared?
That's the global box office take from 2012, The Movie, made 3 years ago. Here's another apocalyptic bestseller.
We came up with the .2012 Black Ale, kind of commemorating the end of the world.
That's Julie Bierencott at Stevens Point Brewery. The beer has the Mayan calendar on the label and goes great with grilled food.
So if you want to go out, you know, grill in some great steaks or salmon, pair it with a .2012 and see what happens, I guess.
The site cafepress.com has sold tens of thousands of doomsday items.
It spawned a new cottage industry, yes.
CEO Bob Marino says most of it's tongue-in-cheek. Think thong underwear that says, time's up, 12:21. Cafe Press only prints items when you order, so they won't have tons of useless stuff if the prophecy's wrong. Lots of tour companies will take you to Mayan ruins for 12:21. I called one that costs $5,000 per person. Straight to voicemail.
Leave a message and we'll get back to you as soon as we re-enter this dimension.
Okay. Religion history professor Philip Jenkins says end-of-the-world prophecies spring up all the time. People quit their jobs, give away all their earthly possessions. So what happens the next day when this pesky world is still around?
Rather than abandon all the huge investment they've put in, plus they don't want to look stupid, they adjust and form often a new kind of religion.
A new date for the end of the world, a new cycle of apocalypse frenzy. He says it's inevitable. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Straight ahead, the Freakonomics of Christmas shopping.
Truth is, you're not that interesting. The person who's about to get the present's going to get dozens of others, and they'll probably forget about what you're going to give them.
All right, man, that's a little harsh, but whatever. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial shaved off 2 points today, just a fraction of 1%, finished at 13,245. The NASDAQ crossed off 8 points, about a quarter percent, wound down to 3,013. The S&P 500 nudged up less than a point, though. Basically flat 14.28. Financial stocks were mixed. Citigroup grew almost 1.5%. Bank of America, 1%. JPMorgan Chase added 0.3%. Eli Lilly said its Alzheimer's drug needs further testing before it seeks FDA approval. That knocked the stock down 3%. Socampo Pharmaceuticals bounced up 2% on the FDA's thumbs up of its treatment for glaucoma. DuPont rose 1.4% today on news it's going to buy back $1 billion worth of its stock. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.70%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. We'll get an idea of how consumers are spending this holiday season when the Commerce Department releases retail sales figures for the month of November. Congress will announce tax relief laws to help rebuild parts of the country hit by Sandy. With that out of the way, Capitol Hill can concentrate on the fiscal cliff, right? And it'll be birthday candles for U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack. He'll be 62. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Ryssdal. All right, so you know the phrase, you can't take it with you? Well, you can't, but if the fiscal cliff negotiations play out the way the White House wants them to, the government is going to take a bigger chunk when you go. One of the many ideas being bandied about as a way to raise revenue is raising the estate tax. We sent our wealth and poverty reporter Shireen Marisol Meraji off to explain how we got here.
The estate tax started in 1916 to help raise money for World War I by taxing what the super rich leave to their heirs.
And what you find are that the big changes in the tax system almost always come about in the middle of a war.
That's Joe Thorndike, my favorite tax historian. He says there were two discussions that World War I brought to a boiling point and that ultimately led to the creation of the estate tax. One, how do we limit the concentration of wealth to maintain our democracy? And two, how should the wealthy bear their fair share of the tax burden?
People who like the estate tax have decided, I think wisely, that they'll get more advantage out of arguing about how the tax burden is shared by people rather than how wealth might be shared by people.
Nearly a century later, estate tax backers are making that argument. This week, Mike Lapham, director of Responsible Wealth, brought a proposal to Congress that calls for an increase in the estate tax to help raise federal revenue.
My great-great-grandfather started a paper mill back in 1865, and my family has paid an estate tax on several occasions.
Lapham says it's only fair that his family pay the government back for the use of paved roads and literate workers educated in public schools. And Lapham adds that only the top 2% of Americans pay the estate tax anyway.
That's not outrageous. That's a very reasonable levy, I think, on people who've done so well.
Republicans say if we don't get things straightened out by January 1st, individuals with estates worth over $1 million could take a hit. And that's not necessarily Bill Gates wealthy. Certified financial planner Luis Barajas has clients in that category and says the estate tax definitely comes up.
I have yet to meet anyone that'll tell me, Luis, I can't wait to die and leave, you know, 35% or 55% of my estate, everything I work hard for, to the government. Not one person has ever said that.
I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji for Marketplace.
A pause now for beer, something in a nice, refreshing microbrew, perhaps. You've probably noticed there are a lot more beer choices now in bars and package stores. The craft brewing scene is well documented. But there's an untold story in the recent explosion of nano breweries, far tinier even than microbreweries. And yet these beer startups, if you will, are becoming a way to turn a hobby into a living, as Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports now from New York.
It's a typically busy Friday night at the downtown bar Jimmy's Number 43. Owner Jimmy Carbone curates a menu serious drinkers love with rare beers from around the world. But right now, he's drinking one from just across the river.
It's just right on. It's like, this is what I want to drink.
It's a pale ale from Queens-based Rockaway Brewing Company. It's a nano brewery, meaning they make only a few kegs at a time. Carbone loves to serve beer from these very tiny area brewers. When he can, that is. They don't make much, and it sells fast. He tapped his keg last night and says it'll be empty by tomorrow. I asked him about other nano brewers he likes.
A good example is that there's a guy, Paul, can't pronounce his last name. He definitely makes some of the weirdest beer out there.
It's pronounced Delugokensky, and his Long Island brewery is called Blind Bat. I caught up with them selling beer at a farmer's market.
Long Island Potato Stout is an extra dry Irish stout. I add Long Island potatoes, organic, honey and basil ale.
Nano Brewer's small scale gives them extreme freedom to experiment, and drinkers covet Delugokensky's creations. He sold every last bottle well before the market closed. Industry numbers show craft brewers overall have captured nearly 10% of the American beer market. The growing thirst for better beer is opening an opportunity for talented home brewers to try going pro through nano brewing.
With more demand right now than supply for craft beer, it's a great way to fill a niche that many people are looking for on the local beer level.
Julia Herz is with the Brewers Association. The craft beer trade group knows of hundreds of breweries operating at nano scale, to say nothing of those which are off the radar.
Okay, so open up the lock here.
After leaving the farmer's market, Delugokensky gave me a tour of the tiny brewery in his cramped garage. It doesn't take long. He's got more buyers than beer, but he's not yet making enough money to quit his day job in publishing. That makes for a grueling schedule.
I'll get up early, around 4:30 in the morning. I'll do some brewery stuff, and I'll hop in the shower, get cleaned up, go to the day job in an office.
Plus, he works nights and weekends, brewing and delivering the beer himself. Working at the nano brewery scale means less risk. He didn't have to raise the mid-six-figure sum it would take to launch a microbrewery. He was able to get going for a bit more than $40,000.
It's a really good way to prove yourself, and I've been approached by a number of people who are interested in investing.
Delugokensky is lining up financing for a $450,000 expansion. Beyond local sellers, Whole Foods has asked for his beer. Many nano brewers with business ambition look up to Dogfish Head. At its Delaware brewery, forklifts move pallets of kegs and bottles roll down the line. It'll all add up to more than 400,000 kegs of beer next year. But it started in 1995 on a brewing system too small to make one keg.
We were nano before nano was cool. The term nano didn't exist yet.
Sam Calagione is Dogfish Head's founder.
The nano brewers are really like the diehard small entrepreneurial companies that make the craft brewing industry so interesting and exciting right now.
We've got an ESB and we've got a stout that just came on tap today.
The black is on tap.
Yep.
That excitement drew Sarah and Tim Marlin to the Queens Industrial Building that houses Rockaway Brewing. They've never heard of nano brewing, but they love the beer.
It's very rich. It's delicious.
And just like that, two more fans. Co-founder Ethan Long puts a Jimmy Cliff record on the turntable and pours a freshly tapped stout. His business partner Marcus Burnett says the song is kind of fitting.
It's a good theme song for our brewery. You get it if you really want.
Why is that?
Because you just got to work really hard and get what you want. You succeed at last.
And nano brewing just might be the path to bigger things. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Mark's got a companion story up at Slate. There's a link straight to it on our website. It's marketplace.org. Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It is that moment every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is, yes, yes, it is, the hidden side of everything. Dubner, how are you?
I'm great, Kai. Happy holidays.
And to you, sir.
Thank you much. I come today with some practical advice
The
gift-giving season because, right. You know, who better to help with your shopping strategy than, wait for it, a bunch of economists.
Oh, dude, you need to get out more, man.
Now, you might think that an economist would simply encourage everybody to buy absolutely as much stuff as they can since that might create jobs for somebody somewhere.
Yep.
But in fact, many economists see gift giving as terribly inefficient, okay? They say that it generates a lot of what's called deadweight loss, which means that you place much less value on the socks or the electronic gadget that I give you than it actually cost in real dollars that I paid for.
Or that my mother-in-law gives me. Oh, wait.
Precisely.
Did I say that on the radio? Yes. Anyway, she's a very nice lady. Might I say, though, that that is especially Scrooge-like of you and them, right? I mean, come on.
It is indeed. In fact, Joel Waldfogel, who is an economist at the University of Minnesota, wrote this book you may know about called Scroogenomics, Why You Shouldn't Buy Presents for the Holidays.
Right.
Here is how Joel Waldfogel approaches the gift game.
All right.
Well, one thing that I like to do in gift giving in the family is to give myself things. Or what I should really say is to get permission to buy myself something special. So if I want to go buy a fancy camera or something, which would be the ideal gift for me, but of course no one else is going to buy it correctly, I can just ask my wife for permission. And if she gives permission, then there I have a wonderful gift.
All right.
So that's what you might call the selfish Santa approach, okay? Plus which nobody could buy it correctly.
That's
for
right.
Me.
Yeah, I love that part.
Now, that may not strike you as being particularly generous. It sure beats, however, what another economist once tried for his wife's birthday. Here's Alex Tabarrok.
I made the mistake of getting my wife a Blu-ray DVD player, a really high-end Blu-ray DVD player for her birthday. This, of course, was something that I actually wanted. So on my birthday, she got me a dress.
I love that. That's actually awesome.
It was quite well done. Now, there are other gift-giving strategies to consider. The economist Justin Wolfers takes what I like to call the anti-narcissist approach.
They have this thing called the spotlight effect. You tend to think that you're in the spotlight and everyone's looking at you. Applying it to Christmas, it's like you think that everyone's looking at the gift you're about to give and it's super important. And so you put a lot more weight on it and maybe you spend a little bit too much. Truth is, you're not that interesting. The person who's about to get the present is going to get dozens of others and they'll probably forget about what you're going
to
give them.
I hate to break it to you. You're just not that interesting. In other words, you know, don't overthink it and don't overspend. Okay?
All right.
That's the message there.
What about your favorite economist, Mr. Levitt?
So Steve Levitt, I asked him about gift giving. I have to say he came back with a really lovely and heartfelt response about what it really means to give someone a gift.
The very best gifts not only show someone that you know about them and care about them, but they actually demonstrate that you know more about them than they know about themselves.
I mean, that's really nice, but it's so unlevitt-like, right? I mean, he's a nice guy, but
he contains multitudes, is what we might have said. So, Kai, let me say this with that spirit in mind, and to demonstrate how much I actually care about you, Kai Rizdal. Yes. I've sent you a couple of gifts. Did you find them there?
I see them sitting here. I should tell you, I didn't get you anything.
It's all right. Okay. There's still time.
All right. Okay.
So you got one with green wrapping paper, one with red, right? Go ahead and open up the red one first, just for kicks.
The red one first. Okay, so I'm just going to shake it for a second, and I'm a little disappointed because I know it's not beer.
Not beer.
I'm just saying.
And if it is beer and you shook it, you got a problem. Yeah.
Compression stockings, compression leg
sleeves. You're a runner there?
I am, yes. And occasionally I get shin splints, yes.
Thought you might like some purple. Yes. I think of it as Kai Rizdal lavender when I look at that color.
No. So things, they go from the knee down to the ankle and they hold you all together down there. Yeah.
Honestly, Kai, I have to say you don't sound all that happy.
Well,
So go ahead and open up the green one then. Go ahead.
Okay, this isn't beer either, dude.
Not beer?
No, you sent me. No, did you really send me money? I can't keep this. This is $100.
That's $100 for you, Kai. Come on, it's Marketplace, baby. I'm showing you the love by showing you the money. Now, don't spend it all in one place. Oh, happy holidays, Kai Rizdal. Do I know you or what?
I feel bad. I didn't get you anything.
You'll feel better when you buy. You'll feel better when you start to spend it.
Stephen Dubner. He's back in a couple of weeks. Freakonomics is the gig. This is awesome. $100.
Yeah, hey.
No, I'm going to have to do something
else
for the office with this. Or what am I going to – am I going to have to mail this back to you now? Is that the deal?
I don't ask questions about the cash payments that we send out to dictators and radio hosts. I've learned.
All right. See ya.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, back to the Fed chairman we go, because you can never get enough of Ben Bernanke, right? At one point today in the press conference, he was asked what he thought of the phrase fiscal cliff.
I think it's a sensible term because I think of the fiscal policies providing support to the economy. If fiscal policy becomes very contractionary, the economy will, I think, go off a cliff.
No wonder he likes it, right? He's the guy who thought of it. Hello? All right. Hello. Goodbye. That's Marketplace from APM. We're done. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.